Principles for Dealing with the Changing World Order, Why Nations Succeed and Fail by Ray Dalio. So I've just finished reading this epic book and it's absolutely brilliant. I think it's a must read for like everyone. I think you want to know how our world works, how empires work, how all the things that are affecting us today, from inflation to social issues, political issues, world issues, trade issues, wars. I think it's really important to read this book. And it shows how interconnected we all are, really. And the differences between why things happen, and also why a man like Ray Dalio is so successful, because he's able to look back at history and look at like 5,000 years of history, whereas most people just focus on like their own lifetime. And even worse, I think a lot of people like lose kind of perspective of even their lifetime or what's happened within their lifetime and the changes that have happened. They're only focused on what happened in the last 2 to 5 years, and they've become very forgetful of, you know, the history of the world and how things change and how things do change. And I think I always say this, I think we underestimate ourselves as human beings. But anyway, this book, fantastic book. For you guys who don't know, Ray Dalio, he has had over 50 years of microeconomic and investing experience. He is the founder of the world's largest hedge fund, which is Bridgewater Associates. That was founded in 1975. Ray is 72 years of age, so he's obviously a very wise man. And he's a billionaire investor. So he attributes a lot of his success to studying history. And, you know, for anyone who wants to be financially successful, I think you can always learn from people who have already done it. And study the best. And even if you don't want to be rich or whatever, I think you have a duty to be on top of your finances, not only for yourself and your family, but for the world in general, because we all need money, because money is a store of value, it's an exchange of value that we all use to compensate each other to compensate each other for the work that we do, you know. So it's your duty to make sure that you're in charge of your cash flow and that your cash is flowing in, and then you can use that cash to, you know, to actually better the world and the economy, you know. So this is really important. So I would state that it's very important to make sure that you're on top of these things. And the best way to be on top of these things is to study the best. And Ray Dalio, again, is a billionaire investor. And he is the founder of Bridgewater, which is one of the most successful hedge funds in the world. So that's who we're learning from. So I've got key points from this book that I learned. I'm going to go over some of the points that he made in the book that I thought were quite important. And we're just going to discuss that. So I've written a lot of notes around this book. So I'm just going to refer to some of the notes because there's a lot of details in here. And I didn't want to, I didn't want those details to be lost. So let's go through some of these notes. So the overview I've got is the most important events that surprised Ray were those events that didn't happen in his lifetime. Like I was saying earlier about most people, things that happen in our lifetime, we might be surprised by, but they've happened many times in history. And this caused him to look at the past 500 years, which allowed him to see patterns in our societies that happened over and over again. This made me think about the COVID-19 pandemic, for example, which happened in 2020. And this was a very difficult time for us all. And it also like really just shocked the world. You know, the economy stopped. A lot of people got sick. A lot of people passed away, unfortunately. But these things have happened before, you know, pandemics have been happening throughout history. You know, things like the Black Plague and all sorts of things have happened in our history that, and this was just one event that was repeating itself, but it's just something that hadn't happened in most of our lifetime. So it was very new, very different. So I found that just reminded me of that event that's quite recent. I mean, I'm recording this in March of 2022. So again, that was quite recent. We've only just come out of that pandemic now, so we weren't really practically or emotionally ready for that kind of event, because it's not happened in most of our lifetimes. So he looks at the Dutch, British, the US, as in the United States, and the Chinese empires, and the rise and decline of the empires and why they happen. So he looks at a variety of different empires, but those are the main ones that he really studies in this book. So one principal takeaway is that when central banks print a lot of money, they buy stocks and gold and commodities, and this causes the prices of those things to rise, whereas the value of the currency, that reserve currency, falls. And again, in 2022, there is a high rate of inflation right now. I think they're saying up to 7% inflation. And this was due to a lot of printing that happened of the money that's been happening throughout the years since 1971, when President Nixon took the US off the gold standard. So that meant that people could no longer exchange their dollars, the dollar notes, for gold in the US Treasury. Now, that is like the equivalent of like Apple issuing receipts and for iPads, and you not being able to now redeem your iPads when you go to an Apple store. But people were okay with that. It's crazy. It makes sense why there's no financial education in schools. It keeps people financially ignorant, so they don't even understand what this means, you know. So I've written that this devaluation of the currency devalued all currencies around the world, as the dollar was the reserve currency for the world. Okay, so this is something that happened in at the end of World War II with the Bretton Woods Agreement, where obviously the US emerged as the world power and they created the rules, and the agreement was, and the treaties with the nations around the world would be that the US dollar would be the default currency. It would be the currency that all currencies are backed by, which in return could be exchanged for gold in the treasury. So Ray Dalio, what he said was he expected to see chaos in the stock market in the next day, but instead the market was up and went on a rise of nearly 25%. Okay, so this surprised Ray because he'd never seen a currency devaluation before. But then when he looked back at history, he saw that this had happened many times before. So, for example, it happened in 1933 and had the same effect. The US dollar was linked to gold, which was running out. It was running out of, because it was spending more than it had gold reserves to exchange for gold. So they were very bad with their money management, basically, like some people are, like many of us have been, you know. But we don't get to just, you know, do these kind of things, but, you know, superpowered nations do, which is crazy to me, because it's basically stealing. To me, I just see it like it's stealing wealth from the people. But anyway, I digress. So President Franklin D. Roosevelt announced on the radio that he would be breaking the country's promise to exchange dollars for gold. Okay, these cases allowed the U.S. to spend more than it earned by printing more dollars, and therefore the increase in dollars without an increase of the country's wealth, and the value of the dollar, it decreased because of this. Okay, so these were used to buy stocks, gold, and commodities, and that caused the prices of these assets to rise. Okay, and again, we're seeing similar things happening right now. you know, stocks are at all-time high. The prices of food and oil and everything else is going up because the valuation of the currency has gone down because, again, we've just come out of a pandemic in which the global pandemic in which a lot of money was printed to keep this economy stimulated because there was no economic activity because there was a massive lockdown. So a lot of businesses weren't able to operate until they obviously found ways to do it. We created virtual workplaces and adapted to that change. But at the beginning, there was not as much economic activity because of the pandemic. So they needed to stimulate the economy. Otherwise, we'd have gone into recession and, you know, there wouldn't have been no economic stimulation unless they printed the money to let people, you know, keep spending, you know, paying their rent and buying food and other luxuries that people ended up buying, or even investments like stocks, like you were saying, gold or things like that, of that nature. So when Ray says, when he studied history even further back, he realized that the exact same thing had happened many, many times before. So this printing of money also happened in 2008 to relieve the mortgage debt crisis. So 2008, when people were, again, doing exactly what the US government did here, they were buying things they couldn't afford, like houses, you know, that they didn't have the money for, and they had to default on their mortgages, and that caused obviously a massive bubble and a crash. So to relieve that debt crisis, again, there was a money printing there, and it happened again, as I was mentioning, in 2020 to relieve the pandemic, the global pandemic driven economic crisis. So, and this will certainly happen in the future, he says. And it's true. I mean, history does repeat itself. This seems to be what governments want to do instead of, like, dealing with the pain of having to default or having to go into a recession or a Great Depression, you know, because obviously that caused a lot of pain, the Great Depression, and it would cause a lot of anarchy maybe in society. So they would prefer to keep things afloat by doing things like printing money. But that's the cause of the system and the cause of basically taking advantage of the system. That's how I see it, but anyway, I digress. So principle, he highlights these principles. So here's a principle, like, to understand what's coming at you, you need to understand what's happened before you. Now, this principle allowed Ray to study how the Roaring Twenties bubble, the 1920s, turned into the 1930s depression, like the Great Depression in 1929 and throughout the 30s. And then this gave him the lessons that allowed him to anticipate and profit from the 2007 bubble, which turned into the 2008 bust with the mortgage debt crisis. Now, if you look at the past in order to handle the future better, that's exactly what we're doing here. And it's important to definitely study history and to study, make sure you understand the past, of, especially in whatever you're looking at, whether it be money or your career or whatever. You need to look at what's done in the past so you can move forward in the future and create more innovative ways of doing things and understand patterns and cycles and understanding that nothing's that unique. You know, we're all trying to be like unique snowflakes, but actually, like, a lot of human behavior is quite predictable, and if we're not aware of it, then we're doomed to repeat it, especially the down things that happen, the terrible things that happen, and we don't want to do that. So, but you can learn from the past and, you know, become very wealthy by understanding these patterns, you know, of the economy and society in general, really. Right, so the changing orders. So he says that three things that hadn't happened in his lifetime caused Ray to do this study in this book. So the first thing was money printing. The second thing was the wealth gap between obviously the haves and the have-nots, the rich and the poor. And the third thing was a rising rival power, which right now is between China, which is the rising power, and the United States, which is the already established power, which is kind of on the decline. So, well, it's on the decline. So these three things motivated Ray to kind of do this study. So when looking at history, Ray saw that three things have happened many times in history and almost always leads to changing domestic and world orders. So the last time this sequence specifically happened, which is the money printing, the wealth gap, and the rising rival power, was between 1930 and 1945, which is the period of which World War II happened, which is quite frightening, to be honest. When you're reading this, you're like, oh my God, please, let's not have a World War III. But we'll talk about that later in this podcast. But he says that the world order is a governing system in which people deal with each other. So there are internal orders, so that's within countries, which are things like the constitution. You got that in the United States with their constitution. All different countries have their kind of constitutions, the way they run the country and the rules and regulations to govern the country. And then you've got the world order, and that's between countries, so that's typically through treaties, like treaties of Versailles or Bretton Woods agreement, things of that nature. So these changes usually happen after wars or when revolutionary new orders defeat weak old orders. Okay, so it's like the rising power, who's strong, is like defeating the decadent older power that's become weak, you know. And again, you're seeing that a lot in this our society right now, with the Western society, which seems to be on a massive decline, in my opinion. You know, the middle class is shrinking. There's a lot of chaos in our society. You know, extreme ideologies seem to be on the rise, on from one extreme to the other. We've gone from one extreme to the other in the way we kind of, in the things we believe. Like, people's roles are not very not very solid. People don't really believe in roles, and you know, anymore. They want to do what they want to do. There's a lot of rebellious. The society seems very rebellious and very emotional right now in the Western world. Whereas I'm seeing in what they call emerging markets, places like Asia, places like Africa, South America. You know, obviously we're talking particularly about China and how they seem to be rising. You know, they've had their hardships and they seem to be building. They've learned from the successes of the West and they're building on that, and they've got more defined roles in their society. People, the middle class is rising. China, you know, the story of China is absolutely amazing considering the leadership of Deng Xiaoping and his kind of capitalist views and structures that he brought to the Communist Party of China, and it's allowed this massive economic growth that has risen, like, he's taken like millions of people out of poverty in China, you know, and they've created mega metropolis cities of like 10 million people where there used to be like a village of like 10,000 people, you know. It's insane. Like, it's really like inspirational, actually, a lot of the stuff that's going there on there. And it's different to the West. Again, I've been to China, but I've been to places in the I live in the West. I live in the UK. I've been to the United States. It's very different, you know, but it doesn't make it good or bad. It's just a different way of living. And I think we need to be more open to like different people. We don't have to live like them, but we have to understand and appreciate that they're just people just trying to do their best like we are, instead of villainizing them, you know. And Ray does talk a lot about that in this book, which I really like. So some examples he gives the US internal order of the Constitution in 1789 was formed after the American Revolution and is still in operation today. The Russia established a new order after the Russian Revolution in 1917, which ended in 1991 in a relatively bloodless revolution, so non-violent revolution, relatively anyway. And China's current constitution began in 1949 with the Chinese Communist Party winning the civil war in China. Today in 2022, the current world order is commonly called the American World Order. So this was formed after the Allies won the Second World War. It was set out in agreements and treaties how global governance and monetary systems work. Okay, so because the Allies won the World War, the United States ended up emerging as the superpower from that war, that massive conflict. So that's why we're under the American system and why the reserve currency has been the dollar, although it looks like a lot of people are starting to take the yuan now, the renminbi, the Chinese currency. Like I'm seeing, hearing stories about the Saudis, Saudi Arabia, like accepting the renminbi for oil and things like that as a reserve currency. A lot of places in the Middle East, obviously places in Africa as well, because China's helping out with the infrastructure in Africa. Obviously they've lent them a lot of money to build, and they've come in and helped build a lot of structures and infrastructure, something the West never did, never wanted to do, but that's what Africa had been asking for rather than charity. The West just came in and took a lot of stuff. You know, they just kind of left them in a bad place where people are now villainizing China for what they're doing, but they're actually doing what any superpower is doing. They're creating allies, you know. But again, like the United States and the Allies won the war. So, you know, they came together to create the new rules for the new world order, which is the American world order, which from the British Empire that we had before. So in 1944, the new world order, or the new world monetary system was set out in the Bretton Woods Agreement, in which the US dollar became the world's reserve currency. And this is the currency that's commonly accepted around the world. So this key factor is a really key factor in the country becoming the dominant world power. And the most powerful nation. Okay, so wherever you go, you see they do accept US dollars. I mean, I remember going to China and I remember having to bring US dollars to convert into yuan, and just understanding that like they accepted US dollars. I didn't quite understand that, but it's because they wanted to reserve, save dollars, because the dollar was the most powerful currency because it's the world's reserve currency. But yeah, one thing I don't understand about that, I don't understand why, for example, the British pound seems to be stronger than the US dollar. So my British pounds always equate to more US dollars. So I've never understood why that is. Maybe that's because of the devaluation of the dollar being the world reserve currency. I'm not sure, because obviously they took over as the world power, so the British pound declined, but yet the British pound still stronger in terms of the currency rate. But that's something probably I have to study a bit more to understand, because I'm not really as educated in currencies and how they work. Obviously, I know that a lot of them are they're supposed to be, if they're not backed by real assets like gold, silver, land, oil, then they're just fiat currencies that can be printed into oblivion. And that's what causes basically the wealth that you and I create through these dollars, pounds, yen, yuan, whatever you want to call it, you know, these means of exchange to go to decrease in value, you know, and meaning things get more expensive because it takes more of them to buy the same goods and services, because there's more of the currency in circulation. So anyway, the big cycle. So Ray studied the rise and fall of the Dutch, British, American and Chinese, as well as the French, German, Spanish, Japanese, Indian, Russian, and Ottoman empires. So, to understand China's patterns better, he also studied the great empires from the Tang Dynasty, the Song Dynasty, the Yuan Dynasty, the Ming Dynasty, and the Qing Dynasties. as well as obviously like the People's Republic of China as we have now. So, and their money's like all the way back down to the year 600. So that's a big, vast history that which he studied in this book, which was really interesting to read about, actually. Really enjoyed that section. It's probably the most interesting section in the book because it's the most relevant of the new changing world order that we're going through today. China and the United States, that conflict that we're seeing play out, you know, we're seeing it with the trade wars. You know, the US don't want to accept Chinese products and services, and the US and the Chinese don't want to accept the US, and, you know, like President Trump talking about Huawei, you know, and how they're spying on the Chinese government, they're using them to spy on the US, which I don't buy that whatsoever. I think if the Chinese government wants to spy on the US, they'll do it in more covert ways rather than use a commercial phone company to do that. I think it's just they didn't like the fact that Huawei was competing with Apple and becoming one of the strongest brands. So it's a more of an economic war there. But there is a risk of what they call a hot war, and I'll talk about that later in this review, which is worrying, and I hope it never happens. But there's only one thing that's a major concern of that happening between China and the United States, and it's to do with Taiwan. So to understand China's pattern better, that's what Ray Dalio did. He looked at the Chinese dynasties and all the way back to the year 600. The pattern transpired in overlapping cycles, so usually lasting between 250 years. This is the patterns of economic powers in general, not just China, but just in terms of like the world order, in terms of different countries becoming the superpowers. So this usually lasts between 250 years with a 10 and 20 to 20 year transition period between them. Usually great conflicts that usually led to great conflicts in that 10 to 20 year transition, because obviously the leading power don't decline power without a fight. Okay, they want to be on top. So that was a very interesting part of the book as well. So the 8 strengths of a global power. So 1, education. 2, inventiveness and technological development. 3, competitiveness in global markets. 4, economic output. 5, a share of world trade. 6, military strength. 7, power of their financial center for capital markets. And 8, the strength of their currency and reserve currency. Okay, so those are the 8 strengths of the global power, of a global power. So what Ray was saying is this is like it's kind of like the vital signs of a human being. You're going to look at different, you know, the lifespan of a human might be, the average lifespan of a human in the Western world might be 80 years, but for some people it might be longer, it might be shorter for other people, and that would depend on various factors, you know, from health, you know, care, to habits, to eating habits, to activity habits, to genetics, predisposition to disease, or, you know, if you're living in a more dangerous area, this kind of stuff. So there's all these different factors, and that will determine maybe a person's lifespan. And that's the same with, in terms of global power's lifespan as the global power. You have these 8 points that are very important. So these strengths also decline in a similar order in the decline. So I noted that China's education system right now, or the way that a lot of Chinese students are choosing to go to university and study, is mainly focused on the science, engineering, technology, and math. So going to university is very expensive, and it's a lot of time and energy. And for most people, they don't need to go to university. You know, this is something I really believe. I think it's a waste of time. You know, I'm a filmmaker, and I studied media studies at university. Again, I wasn't as savvy as I am now. I wish I knew what I knew now. I never would have gone. Even going to film school for a filmmaker, you know, although you get to learn practical things like how to operate cameras and lighting and sound and technical skills, working with actors, which is great, but you can learn that through courses and through just practically getting experience by, you know, creating YouTube videos, or by, you know, getting a gig as a runner and then getting yourself on the ladder, like most jobs, and actually earn while you learn, you know. Obviously you need skills and experience. That's what I found out as soon as I left the university. That's all everyone was asking about. So I was like, I spent all this time at university and I didn't have the skills and experience that they wanted. Versus like with certain things like engineering or a doctor, you know, you need to study the medicine or the, you know, or surgery and things of that nature. You can't do that on the job, you know, because it's if you make a mistake in that arena, it's more, or law, for example, it's more devastating. So you need to have, they have very good training systems in the school system for science, engineering, technology and math. It doesn't mean everybody needs to do that. It just means if you're going to university to study those things, then it's best to go and study those things if you're going to spend that money and time, because they're trained well, and then you'll ended up getting a job that's actually well paid in that arena, that's going to have a big benefit to society. You're able to pay back your debts, as opposed to most people who do social sciences in the West, you know, like in the United States, for example. Like that's that most people aren't going to college for those kind of degrees. They're going for, like, you know, social studies and things of that nature, which don't produce a good return on your investment for the money that you're investing in these academic subjects. You're better off buying books and, you know, going on YouTube and going to social events and learning social skills that way, rather than studying it at university and spending like tens of thousands, some people even in the United States, hundreds of thousands of dollars on social studies. Yeah, learn technical engineering or computer science and things of that nature. But that's what the Chinese are doing a lot in their education, and something I've noted a lot more than people in the West are a lot more liberal, a lot more, you know, the Chinese system is very different to the West, you know. And again, I'll talk about that in a moment, but they're very much about the unity of the family and the unity of China as a whole, as opposed to the best thing for the individual. So it's a different mindset that they have. It's just different, you know. It's not better or worse, it's just different, you know. We have to understand that and learn from that, and, you know, just understand that, and just get on with each other, so we can, like, all benefit from each other's, you know, skills and each other's, you know, economic output. So the big cycle usually begins after a major conflict, so it's usually a war, unfortunately, that establishes a new leading power and a new world order. So because no one wants to challenge this power, there is a period of peace and prosperity. So people bet on this peace and prosperity continuing, again, like I was saying at the top of this podcast, because you don't see, especially like in my lifetime, for example, my generation hasn't seen a major war in terms of like living in the UK. You know, I didn't experience World War II. I didn't experience the Blitz. You know, we see wars going on in other countries. Like at the moment, you have the Ukraine and Russia at war. And it seems really like alien, and it seems really, you know, horrible that, you know, people are having to fight and die right now because a sovereign state's being invaded for all sorts of complicated reasons that I'm not going to get into or pretend like I understand. But, you know, it's sad to see, because you never want to see people like dying and, you know, being bombed and shot at and killed and all of this over things I think we can come to a democratic kind of conclusion with. But again, like, this is a new, it's a new, there's new patterns that happen in history that we don't necessarily experience in our lifetime, that it's important to read history because they do repeat themselves. And it might happen in our lifetime, it might not. But what Ray's saying, he's seen these things happen in his lifetime or in our lifetime that he hadn't seen before, but he realizes it's happening over and over again. And that's the point of this book. It happens over long periods of time that might be lifetimes, but they could be due today. You never know. Right, anyway, unless you study history, of course. So, again, no one wants to challenge the power. So, you know, people bet on the peace continuing because that's what keeps the peace, because that superpower is so strong. So it leads to borrowing money for this, and this continues, and it creates financial bubbles. So the empire share of the trade grows, and as these transactions are conducted in the currency of the empire, then it becomes a reserve currency. And at the same time, distributes wealth unevenly, so there's a wealth gap that increases between the rich haves and the poor have-nots. And this is a real problem, because I think I'm never debunk anyone for being rich. I think it's important to understand the rules and become as rich as you can, so you can have the freedom to live the life that you want to live, and also so you can keep the economy stimulated. Because when you have wealth, you're able to spend your money, you're able to invest your money, you're able to use money. Money is not supposed to be hoarded, it's supposed to be used, especially because it's a currency, which means to move. It's a current, it needs to move, it needs to go from, like, my income or someone else's expense to provide a good and a service. They needed a video created, they needed, you know, a creative services, so they came to me. I produced a video for them that's going to help their business, and that business is then going to flourish because that video is going to produce income for them, and it's going to provide a service to somebody else. Could be a merchant who sells books or who sells medical services, and that's going to provide benefit to someone else who's spending money for that service, and that's going to enrich their life, and then they're going to be able to do that. It's a cycle, it needs to continue. So it's important to be rich, it's important to have money, it's important not to be poor, because poverty leads to conflicts. But the problem is that we have the wealth gap between the haves and the have-nots, and it becomes too wide. And when it becomes too wide, that's when you have revolutions, that's when you have crime problems. Because people, how can you have people in one breath who can buy handbags for like 10 grand and not even care, and then other people don't have enough to pay for food to eat today? That to me is ridiculous. Everybody should have enough to eat, at least. I'm not saying everybody should have the ability to buy $10,000 handbags. I think you need to earn that ability and that power. But I think everybody needs to have enough, at least the opportunity to have enough to earn the a decent living, so they have food and shelter and water and the basic things in life, because we have more than enough. So that's something I'm really adamant about, even though I'm not really a socialist in terms of thinking that everything should be distributed equally. I believe that I believe in equal opportunities, but not equal outcomes. But definitely don't believe in massive wealth gaps where, again, some people are able to buy $10,000 handbags, or more power to them, but on the same place, someone else doesn't have enough to eat. That doesn't make sense to me. But it's a complicated thing. But a lot of the things, this book explains why a lot of those things happen, I think. So, these gaps between the haves and have-nots can, you know, obviously cause, you know, problems and conflicts. So eventually the financial bubble bursts, and it leads to the printing of money. So governments begin printing money. The increased internal conflict between the rich and the poor, which leads to some form of revolution, to redistribute the wealth. And this can happen peacefully, or it can happen as a civil war. Obviously, we always hope that these things happen peacefully, but unfortunately, as humans, we're flawed. And a lot of the times, these conflicts can lead to wars and civil wars and civil conflict, you know, and internal conflicts. As empires struggle with this internal conflict, its power diminishes relative to the external powers on the rise. When a new power, rising power, becomes strong enough to compete with the dominant established power, external conflicts, most typically wars, take place. And from these internal and external wars and conflicts, the new winners, they come up, and together they establish the new world order, and the cycle then continues again. Okay, so what Ray said was he saw that these cycles happened all the way back to the Roman Empire. They happened over and over and over and over again. This is, these things, history is just like, you know, it doesn't repeat itself, but it rhymes. You know, it's just the same tune, but we're just wearing different clothes. He says different, you know, we're in different clothes and we have different technologies, but the same things are happening over and over and over again. It's almost, it's really predictable when you look at it. So looking at the state of the 8 indicators that we mentioned earlier of an empire, just like looking at the health of an individual, like I mentioned, it allows you to see the lifespan. So Ray, what he does was, it allows Ray to look at what stage the country is in, and it allows him to anticipate what may happen next. It's not obviously like a crystal ball, but it's a predictor of what may happen. So the cycle has 3 phases. Number 1 is the rise. Number 2 is the top. And number 3 is the decline. Okay, so we'll go over the rise first. So the rise, it's typically started with by revolutionary leaders doing 4 things. 1, they win power, getting more support than the opposition. 2, they consolidate power by converting, weakening, or eliminating the opposition so they don't stand in their way. 3, they establish systems and institutions that make the country work well. And 4, they pick their successor or their successors well, and then, or they create systems that do this. Okay, so then there's a period of peace and prosperity, as no one wants to challenge the world leading power, as we mentioned earlier. They must have a strong education. So this is not just teaching knowledge and skills, but it's also teaching character, civility, and work ethic. So this is something I think is lacking a little bit in the West right now. There's a lot of weak characters in our society who act emotionally a lot, you know. There's a lot of, you know, people not understanding roles in society. Whereas in China, I see in places like that, not Western countries, I see there's a lot of strong characters in the people, because they've obviously dealt with a lot of hardships and they're on the rise. And there's a better work ethic, you know, because obviously we've been living in prosperity so long, so we're not as strong necessarily emotionally and, you know, as some of these emerging markets are. So something that I've as an observation, you know, I've noticed in general, and I could be wrong about that, but that's just something from my own life experience I'm definitely seeing myself. So the education of the people, again, not just knowledge and skills, but character, civility, and work ethic, which I think is probably even more important, because that's how, if you have a strong character, civility, and work ethic, that's how you can generate knowledge and skills. You know, it gives you the discipline to go out and acquire knowledge and skills, and not just expect everything to be handed to you on a platter, you know, because you're so special, which is what, again, our Western society seems to be declining into as we become more decadent. So they say that, he said that it's typically it's taught in the family, you know, or the school system or the religious institutions, all of which seem to be declining. Like you see now with Western society, or even in the world in general, the birth rate's going down, you know, because individualism is going up. People don't believe in the institution of the family, of marriage, things of that nature. You see a lot of divorce rates. The divorce rate's like 50%. 80% of it is initiated by women, especially in the West, because there's a lot of incentives for women to break those vows because of the the way the law systems, the family court systems are set up in a lot of these Western countries, you know, there's a lot of issues in our society where, again, you don't have that strong family unit, you know. And again, going back to China is very much about the family. It's very much about the government. The government system is structured more like a company or a family unit, where the government is the parent and everybody else is the children, and the government makes the decisions on what's best for the country, but everybody else kind of follows suit, and it's all about what's best for the family, what's best for China as a whole, what's best for the community. And those values are very strong in China. I can tell you that firsthand, from because I lived there for like 6 months. So, and I have one of my best friends is Chinese. He lives in Shanghai. And I can definitely tell you those values are definitely there, a lot more than they are in the West, in the school systems as well. And the religious institutions, again, it's not as strong as it used to be, I think, in the West. So that's an interesting observation. So this develops healthy respect for the rules and laws, order within society. It lowers corruption and enables them to unite towards a common purpose. So it reminds, again, I noted that it reminded me of like a company, a strong company like Apple, like how they are run by, you know, these kind of ethics and these kind of rules and systems. And same with the economic power rise of China right now. A lot of those things can be pointed out with China. So as they do this, they move into producing basic products, from producing basic products to inventing new technologies. Okay, so a great example is the Dutch, the rise of the Dutch when they defeated the Habsburg Empire. So they became very educated and came up with a quarter of all the world's inventions, which is insane. It's absolutely amazing. So this included the Dutch windmill, 1670, and the invention of ships, so the Dutch fleet in 1677, which allowed them to travel around the world collecting or stealing, I put in brackets, great riches. Okay, so that invention, it allowed for a greater exploration of the world, greater knowledge, which created these inventions such as the windmill and many other things, which shows why they rose in power, or the result of that rise in power, which we see over and over again in all these different rising empires. So they, like all great empires, enhanced their thinking by embracing the best thinking in the world. Okay, so they were open to the best thinking in the world. Obviously they traveled with the ships and they could embrace different thinking. And that reminds me of Deng Xiaoping, and actually his, when China was suffering under Mao, and he then took charge, he looked at different countries in Asia and in Europe and in the Western world and how they were flourishing with capitalism after the war, and how obviously the difference between them and China, and how people weren't starving and people were able to, you know, live great lives, and, you know, they, you know, were able to prosper at work and, you know, and have a lot of prosperity and productivity and the good things about capitalism that he saw. And instead of staying rigid to China's communist system, he brought that capitalistic system into play, you know. And he's famous for his quote of, "It's glorious to be rich, and I don't care whether it's a black cat or white cat as long as it catches mice," you know. And this was his whole philosophy about taking the best of the world and bringing it to China and helping China, you know, because that was the purpose. It wasn't to be rigid, it wasn't to do it the Chinese way, it was more to see, take the best of what the Chinese system offered, and also take the best of what the world had to offer and what was working in the world that wasn't working in China, and apply that And this is why they've risen so fast in society, because of that leadership from Deng Xiaoping. And again, with the Dutch Empire, their ability to travel, their ability to look at other people's success and to take in different, you know, ideas, that's what allowed them to obviously have a strong empire. So they, like all empires, enhance their thinking by embracing the best thinking in the world, as I was saying. And as a result, people and the country became more productive, which means that they are more competitive in the world market, which shows up in their growing economic output and rising share of world trade. So I noted as well that this is happening in China and in the US, or Ray noted that, should I say, that that's happening in China and the US, so right now. So as countries trade more globally, they must develop a great military strength to protect their trade routes and foreign interests from attack. It's very important to have a strong military. You can't let people bully you. You can't let people, you know, you need to have that presence. So that the irony is, having a strong military keeps the peace, you know. Like the Cold War, as terrible as it was because it created all these nuclear weapons, that, you know, you try and look at the bright side of all these terrible things if you can. It's very difficult, but if you try, like the way I see it is, it kept everyone in check to realize, oh my God, we've all got these horrible weapons, we can't use them, because if we do, we'll destroy each other. So let's not bother invading each other, because we all have these terrible weapons that could destroy each other. So there's no point in us to continue invading each other. So there's been, this is like a period of time where in history where there's not been as many of these invasions as there have been in the past. Obviously, they're, you know, right now, I'm not like excusing like or forgetting what's happening in the Ukraine, where Russia have invaded, and they have invaded other nations before, and you know, there's many other countries that have had lots of conflicts that on a small or on a scale that's not in our mainstream media in the West, and it's been happening. There's been some terrible things that happened around the world, and terrible conflicts between sovereign states, but it hasn't been on a mass scale that it has been through history. And I think it's due to the threat of, you know, nuclear war, for example, and just the power of those nuclear weapons and the weapons systems that we now have in place. We just don't want that to happen. I don't think we want a World War III, because it will be devastating for everybody. So, like, everybody loses if that happens. So, and I think we're more educated, we've recorded more history, we're more aware of each other's cultures. Well, at least I'd like to believe so anyway. Some people not more than others, but in general, we have the ability with the internet to see other sides of the world, you know. And realize they're just people, you know, just like us. And I think that's allowed a lot more empathy as well. So, but as well, but I think the main thing is actually the threat of, you know, of knowing other countries have like weapons that can destroy each other. So, you know, having a strong military stops, that's why it stops these conflicts. That's why when the New World Order takes place, there is a large period of time, or a long period of time, that we have a lot of prosperity, you know. Right, so this is this podcast, I've written a lot of notes. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to do a second part of this podcast, and we're going to continue on with the rise, and then we'll talk about the top and the decline, and some additional notes that I made in later chapters from Ray Dalio. But this is a fantastic book. It's definitely worth getting if you haven't. And I'll see you in part two. For part two of this podcast. Okay, peace.